Welcome to our deep dive into the Book of the Covenant. You're
Yes.
here because you want to learn more about Exodus chapters 20.22 to 23.33.
Huh?
And let me tell you, this section, it's like a time machine back to ancient Israel,
Right.
showing us their laws and how they saw their relationship with God.
Yeah.
We're going to be uncovering some fascinating insights into themes of holiness, justice, and even how some of these ancient laws foreshadow ideas we see in the New Testament.
It's amazing how relevant these ancient texts still are.
Absolutely.
The Book of the Covenant isn't just some dusty collection of rules.
Yeah.
It gives us a window into a society figuring out
Yeah.
how to live right by each other and with God.
Totally. Okay, so picture this.
Okay.
The Israelites have just escaped slavery in Egypt, and they're at Mount Sinai,
Right.
where they receive this detailed set of laws.
Yes.
It's a pretty pivotal moment for them, right?
Absolutely.
Oh,
like
honest.
imagine yeah imagine being a newly formed nation,
right?
Free from oppression.
Yeah.
But with no real structure for society.
Right.
The Book of the Covenant becomes their blueprint,
okay,
their guide for building a just and holy society.
It's like their constitution.
Yeah.
But with a heavy emphasis on the divine.
Uh-huh.
It makes you wonder if having that strong spiritual foundation was key to their survival.
Sure.
So where do they even begin?
Well, the very first laws deal with something pretty fundamental: worship.
Okay.
And you see a stark contrast with the Egyptian practices they just left behind.
Right.
No elaborate golden idols here.
Uh-huh.
Instead, they're instructed to build a simple altar of earth and undressed stone.
Oh, wow.
It reflects the idea that God's presence is something you experience.
Yeah.
Not something you try to capture in a statue.
That's a powerful image.
Yeah.
So they're being told to reject the flashy extravagance of Egyptian religion.
Uh-huh.
And embrace a simpler, more direct connection with God.
Yes.
Almost like saying true faith is about what's in your heart, not what's on display.
Yes. And goes deeper than that.
Even the detail about priests covering themselves
right.
points to this shift away from the sensuality of pagan worship
uh-huh.
toward a more inward focus on holiness.
Got it.
It's a complete redefinition of what it means to connect with the divine.
It's like they're building this invisible wall
yeah.
between the sacred and the profane.
Right.
And it all starts with how you approach worship.
Exactly.
And I'm guessing this emphasis on simplicity and humility continues to influence their practices later on, right?
You're absolutely right.
Okay.
Think about the construction of the temple in Jerusalem.
Uh-huh.
Solomon made sure no iron tools,
okay.
tools of war and the secular world,
right.
were used to build this sacred space
wow.
that echoes the same concept of purity and reverence we see in the Book of the Covenant.
The continuity is incredible.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've talked about worship,
mm-hmm.
but the Book of the Covenant also deals with some pretty heavy stuff.
Yeah.
Like capital offenses and laws concerning physical abuse.
Right.
That must have been a complex area to navigate.
It was, and that's where we come across the concept of lex talionis.
Okay.
Or the law of exact equivalence.
Right.
It's sometimes misinterpreted as promoting harshness.
Uh-huh.
But it's really more about ensuring fairness
yeah.
and preventing excessive punishment.
Oh.
It was a safeguard against the kind of arbitrary justice that was common in other ancient legal systems.
So instead of seeking revenge,
right.
it's more about making sure the punishment fits the crime.
Exactly.
Could you give us an example of how that worked in practice?
Sure. Let's say someone intentionally injures another person.
Okay.
The punishment would be a similar injury inflicted on the offender.
Got it.
It's a way of establishing proportionality.
Right.
And preventing things from spiraling into uncontrolled violence.
That makes sense, though. It does sound a little harsh to modern ears.
Yeah.
But I guess in a society without established prisons
right.
or complex legal systems,
yes.
this was a way to maintain some level of order. What's interesting is that even within a system that allowed slavery, the Book of the Covenant provided specific protections for slaves.
Yes.
Especially against abuse.
Right.
It's like
they wouldn't allow the kind of cruelty they themselves experienced in Egypt to be inflicted on others.
Right.
It's like they're saying, we know what it's like to be powerless.
Uh-huh.
And we won't perpetuate that suffering.
There's a real sense of empathy. There, a recognition of shared humanity.
Absolutely.
It's like they're weaving compassion into the very fabric of their laws.
Yes.
And that thread continues as we move into the laws concerning property rights and animal welfare.
It does. Uh-huh. The concept of intent is crucial here.
Right.
The severity of the punishment depended on whether the person knew their actions could cause harm.
Can you give a specific example of that?
Absolutely. If your ox gores someone,
okay,
the penalty is more severe if you knew the ox had a history of aggression but didn't take precautions. It's about being responsible, not just for yourself, but for those under your care, both human and animal.
So it's about taking responsibility for your actions and their potential consequences.
Yes.
It reminds me of Jacob's story.
Uh-huh.
When he was tending Laban's flocks and made restitution for any animals that were harmed, even if it wasn't his fault.
That's a great example of how these legal principles from the Book of the Covenant
weren't
just abstract ideas.
Right.
They were woven into the fabric of their daily lives, shaping their ethical behavior and their interactions with each other.
It's like they understood that living in right relationship wasn't just about avoiding punishment.
Mm-hmm.
It was about cultivating a sense of responsibility toward each other and the world around them.
Exactly.
But speaking of things that could get you in trouble,
okay,
the Book of the Covenant also delves into some pretty serious offenses.
Right.
Like seduction, sorcery, and apostasy.
Yes, and this is where things get really interesting.
Okay.
We see them drawing clear lines between their faith and the practices of surrounding cultures.
Let's start with seduction.
Okay.
What did their laws say about that?
The Book of the Covenant deals specifically with the seduction of a virgin who isn't betrothed.
Okay.
It's important to distinguish this from rape.
Right.
Which carried a much harsher penalty.
Yeah.
In this context, seduction refers to a man persuading a woman into a sexual relationship, essentially taking away her virginity and her social standing as a potential bride.
But isn't this still putting the burden of responsibility on the woman?
Mm.
How does that line up with our modern ideas about consent and agency?
That's a great question and highlights the differences between their cultural context and ours.
Right.
In their society, a woman's virginity was directly tied to her family's honor and her prospects for marriage.
Uh-huh.
So while it might seem unfair from our perspective, it reflects the social and economic realities of the time.
I see what you mean.
Yeah.
It's a reminder that we always have to consider the historical and cultural context.
Mm-hmm.
When interpreting these ancient laws.
Right.
So what were the consequences for the man involved in a seduction case?
He was obligated to pay the woman's father a bride price.
Okay.
Acknowledging the damage done to her reputation and the potential loss her family faced.
Wow.
Later laws even required him to marry her and prohibited him from ever divorcing her.
Oh, wow.
They clearly saw this as a serious offense.
Okay, no casual flings in ancient Israel. Got it.
Right.
So let's move on to sorcery.
Okay.
You mentioned that this is where we see the concept of tu'eva.
Yes.
Something utterly abhorrent.
Uh-huh.
Why was sorcery seen as such a threat?
Sorcery, with its roots in pagan beliefs and practices,
right,
was considered a direct challenge to their covenant with God.
Yeah.
It was like saying, we don't need you, God. We can get power from these other sources.
Right.
And that was simply unacceptable.
They were drawing a hard line.
Yes.
Separating themselves from the practices of surrounding cultures.
Exactly.
And the punishment for sorcery was pretty severe, right?
It was.
Like, what was it?
The penalty was death.
Oh, wow.
Sorcery was seen as a form of rebellion, a turning away from the one true God.
Right.
Towards powers considered dangerous and deceptive.
Got it.
It was, in their eyes, a betrayal of everything they stood for.
And along similar lines, we have apostasy.
Yes.
Which also carried the death penalty.
Right.
What made this offense so great?
Apostasy in this context refers specifically to the act of sacrificing to other gods.
Okay.
It wasn't just about private beliefs.
Right.
It was about public actions that showed allegiance to another deity.
So it was an outward expression of.
Yes. This was seen as a complete rejection of God's authority and a violation of their covenant with him.
So messing around with other gods was a big no-no in ancient Israel.
It was a serious offense.
But what was the actual punishment? Was it just a simple death sentence?
It went beyond that.
Okay.
The punishment known as harem,
right,
which translates to the curse of destruction, involved complete annihilation of everything associated with the person.
Oh, wow.
Imagine it like being totally erased from the community. Your belongings destroyed, your name forgotten.
That's intense.
It was a powerful reminder of the seriousness of their commitment to God.
It's like a spiritual quarantine.
Yes.
Protecting the community from being contaminated by this act of betrayal. It shows how deeply they value their relationship with God and the importance of remaining faithful to him.
Absolutely.
But after these offenses, the focus shifts back to something we talked about earlier.
Okay.
Protecting the vulnerable.
Yes. And it's interesting how they explicitly connect these laws to their own experience as foreigners in Egypt.
Right. They're essentially saying, we know what it's like to be mistreated and marginalized.
Exactly.
So we won't do that to others.
They were commanded to care for widows, orphans, and strangers. Those who were often overlooked or taken advantage of in society.
It's remarkable how they turn their personal experience of suffering into a call for action.
Yeah.
A mandate to create a more just and compassionate society.
Right.
And it's not just about avoiding punishment from God. There's a genuine sense of empathy and concern for those in need.
Yes. And you see this beautifully expressed in Exodus 22.27,
okay,
where it says, at least with me, he will find compassion.
That's beautiful.
It reflects God's own heart for the vulnerable and foreshadows the emphasis on compassion we see in Jesus' teachings centuries later.
It's like we're witnessing the evolution of ethical thought.
Yeah.
The seeds of a moral revolution are being planted right here in the Book of the Covenant.
Right.
It's incredible to see how these ancient laws, with their focus on justice and compassion, lay the groundwork for principles that would later become central to Christianity.
It's a powerful reminder that even these ancient texts have something to teach us today.
Absolutely.
About how to live justly and love mercy, just as the prophet Micah proclaimed.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's amazing how the Book of the Covenant doesn't just focus on outward actions. It also addresses our duties to God.
Yeah.
It's like they understood that a just society starts with a right relationship with the divine.
You've hit on a key point, and this section begins with a seemingly simple but profound command.
Okay.
You will not revile God nor curse your people's leader.
It's interesting how those two ideas are paired together, like respect for God and respect for those in authority. Is this about blind obedience, or is there something more nuanced going on here?
It's definitely more nuanced. Remember, the Israelites saw their leaders as divinely appointed.
Right.
So disrespecting them was seen as challenging God's will.
Uh-huh.
But it also speaks to the importance of order and stability within society.
Right.
Like, a community can't function if everyone is constantly undermining those in leadership positions.
It makes you think about how we view authority today.
Yeah.
And where that line is between healthy dissent and outright disrespect.
Mm-hmm.
It's a delicate balance for sure.
It is. But back to the text.
Okay.
After this injunction against reviling God and cursing leaders.
Right.
We move into the concept of giving back to God from the abundance he has provided.
Okay. So it's not just about avoiding bad behavior. It's about actively demonstrating gratitude and generosity.
Exactly.
And what did this giving look like in practice? Was it like a tithe or something more elaborate?
Well, there was a general instruction to be generous with offerings. But then we get into some very specific and to modern ears.
Okay.
Somewhat shocking details.
Okay.
They were commanded to offer the firstborn of their children and their flocks and herds to God.
Wait, hold on. Offering their firstborn children? That's pretty intense.
Right.
I can't imagine that going over well today.
It does sound extreme.
Right.
But it's important to view it through the lens of their cultural context.
Right.
At this time, the firstborn males served a priestly function, offering sacrifices to God. It was seen as a high honor, dedicating the best to the divine. Later, the Levites took on this priestly role.
Okay.
And the practice evolved.
So it was more about dedication and service than an actual sacrifice.
Precisely.
It was a way of acknowledging God's blessings and giving back in a way that reflected their deep devotion.
And even with the firstborn animals, it was a waiting period. The firstborn stood with its mother for 7 days.
Right.
And was then offered to God on the 8th day.
There's that number 7 again.
Yeah.
Is that connected to the 7 days of creation?
You're right on the mark.
Okay.
The 7 day period symbolized a complete cycle. And the offering on the 8th day signified a new beginning.
Got it.
Think of it like this.
Okay.
7 represents completion, and 8 represents what's beyond that.
Okay.
A step into something new and transformative.
It's like they're weaving this idea of cyclical time into their rituals, connecting their lives to the rhythms of creation. And isn't the 8th day also significant for circumcision?
Exactly. Male infants were circumcised on the 8th day.
Okay.
And it's not a coincidence that the ordination of priests also involved a 7 day consecration period, culminating in their service on the 8th day. There's a beautiful symmetry here.
Yeah.
A sense of continuity between the dedication of humans and animals to God's service.
It's fascinating how they created this tapestry of meaning weaving together seemingly disparate elements like ritual, symbolism, and everyday life, it shows how deeply their faith was integrated into every aspect of their existence.
And that tapestry continues
okay.
as we move on to another cornerstone of their lives, the Sabbath.
The day of rest. We hear a lot about the Sabbath in the Bible.
Uh-huh.
But it's clearly more than just a day off.
Right.
What was the deeper significance of this practice for the Israelites?
The Sabbath was foundational to their relationship with God.
Okay.
The command to rest mirrored God's rest after creation, placing them within the divine order of the cosmos.
Right.
It wasn't simply about physical rest.
Oh, right.
It was about entering into a spiritual state of peace and communion with God.
So it was about aligning themselves with God's rhythm of work and rest.
Yes.
Acknowledging their place within the grand scheme of creation. And this idea of Sabbath rest wasn't just limited to humans, right?
You're right.
Like, they extended it to the land itself.
They were commanded to let their fields lie fallow every seventh year.
Okay.
A practice known as the sabbatical year.
Uh-huh.
It prevented soil depletion, ensuring long-term productivity.
Right.
But it also had social implications.
Oh, okay.
The poor could glean from the fields.
Uh-huh.
And even wild animals could benefit. It was a beautiful expression of care for the land and those in need.
It sounds almost like a utopian ideal, this vision of a society where everyone, even the land itself, gets a chance to rest and be restored. It's a powerful reminder of the interconnectedness of all things.
It is. And while the reality might not have always lived up to the ideal, the principle behind it is profound.
Mm.
It speaks to a deep understanding that our well-being is tied to the well-being of the earth and those around us.
It's interesting how this idea of Sabbath rest doesn't just look back to creation, but also points forward to something greater. Isn't there a connection to the idea of a future rest for the faithful?
Absolutely. The Sabbath foreshadows a future rest.
Okay.
A kind of ultimate Sabbath that transcends the limitations of this world.
Right.
The book of Hebrews describes this future rest as a time when we will rest from our works just as God did from his.
Wow.
It's a beautiful vision of eternal peace and communion with God.
It's amazing how these seemingly simple laws about a day of rest hold such profound theological implications.
Yeah.
It's like they're little windows into a deeper understanding of God's plan for humanity.
And those windows open even wider.
Okay.
As we move to the final section of the Book of the Covenant, where we encounter those fascinating pilgrim feasts.
Okay, let's talk feasts. We've got unleavened bread, weeks, and shelters. What's the significance of these particular celebrations? Were they just big parties? Or was there a deeper meaning behind them?
Well, on the surface, they were connected to the agricultural cycle, marking key points in the harvest season.
Uh-huh.
It was a way of expressing gratitude and giving back to God from the abundance he provided.
Okay.
But they also served as a powerful reminder of their history.
Right.
Specifically, their exodus from Egypt, and each feast had its own unique symbolism and potential connection to New Testament practices.
So they were more than just celebrations. They were pilgrimages of gratitude, a physical journey that mirrored their spiritual journey as a people.
Yeah.
It's like they were enacting their faith through these rituals and ceremonies.
That's a great way to put it. And each feast offers unique insights.
Okay.
Let's start with the Feast of Unleavened Bread.
Okay.
It commemorates the Israelites' hasty departure from Egypt. Their bread unleavened because there was no time to wait for it to rise. Yeah. Right. That sense of urgency of leaving the old life behind and embracing the new resonates with the Christian experience of baptism.
It's like that unleavened bread becomes a symbol of spiritual transformation.
Exactly.
You're leaving behind the old ways, the old you,
mm-hmm.
and stepping into a new life with God.
And then there's the Feast of Weeks, later known as Pentecost.
Right.
This feast celebrates the giving of the law at Mount Sinai, the moment the covenant was established.
True.
In the Christian tradition, Pentecost is when the Holy Spirit descended on the disciples, empowering them to spread the good news. It's another powerful connection.
Yeah.
A moment when God's presence and power are made manifest in a new and transformative way.
So both feasts are about new beginnings.
Yes.
But in different ways.
Uh-huh.
One is about personal transformation.
Right.
The other about the birth of the church and the spread of the gospel.
Exactly.
It's amazing how these seemingly disparate events are linked by a common thread of God's action in human history.
You're getting it. And finally, we have the Feast of Shelters, or Tabernacles.
Uh-huh.
This feast commemorated the Israelites' time wandering in the wilderness, living in temporary shelters.
Mm-hmm.
It's a reminder of their dependence on God, their vulnerability and their need for his guidance.
Got it.
It's a powerful image of trusting in God's provision, even when surrounded by uncertainty.
And this one also has some intriguing connections to New Testament ideas, right?
Yes.
Like the idea of our bodies as temples of the Holy Spirit.
The temporary shelters or booths that they built during this feast were reminiscent of the tabernacle, the portable sanctuary that housed the Ark of the Covenant.
Right.
This foreshadows the Christian understanding of our bodies as temples of the Holy Spirit.
Okay.
Temporary dwellings for the divine presence.
It's remarkable how these ancient practices, rooted in their specific historical context, can still offer us insights into our own spiritual journeys. It's like these feasts provide a tangible way for us to connect with the stories and experiences of those who came before us, deepening our understanding of faith and its enduring power.
And there's one more fascinating detail about the Feast of Tabernacles.
Okay.
It involved a ritual pouring of water, symbolizing the outpouring of God's blessing.
Right.
This practice has clear parallels with the Christian sacrament of baptism, where water signifies cleansing and new life.
Wow. It's like we're seeing these echoes of the New Testament hidden within the rituals of the old. It's a beautiful reminder of the continuity of God's plan for humanity unfolding across time and cultures.
And it speaks to the enduring power of these ancient texts to speak to us across millennia.
Absolutely.
They challenge us to dig deeper, to explore those connections, and to discover the hidden treasures of meaning that can enrich our understanding of faith.
You know, as we're talking about these feasts, I can't help but think about that command. No one will appear before me empty-handed. I remember reading that in Deuteronomy.
Right.
And it always kind of stuck with me.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Yes, that's a crucial detail. It emphasizes that participating in these feasts wasn't just about showing up.
Right.
It was about bringing an offering that reflected the blessings you'd receive.
It wasn't just about going through the motions.
Right.
It was about actively expressing gratitude through your actions.
Exactly. And what's really interesting is that Deuteronomy adds another layer to this idea.
Okay.
It says each person should give in proportion to the blessing which Yahweh your God has bestowed on you.
That's a powerful statement.
It is.
It suggests a direct link between the abundance you've experienced and the generosity of your offering. It's almost like a sliding scale of giving.
Right.
Where those who've received more are expected to give more in return.
Exactly.
It's a concept that resonates even today, doesn't it?
It does.
We often talk about giving back to our communities. Supporting those in need.
Right.
It makes you think about what it truly means to appear before God.
Yeah.
Not literally in a temple.
Right.
But in our everyday lives, what are the offerings we bring?
That's a profound question. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, it goes beyond material offerings.
Okay.
It's about offering our talents, our very selves, in service to God and others.
So it's about making our lives a living testament to our gratitude.
Yes.
Wow, this deep dive into the Book of the Covenant has been incredible.
It has.
We've uncovered so much from the foundation of worship to the intricacies of justice and the importance of compassion.
Yes.
And seeing those connections to the New Testament, those echoes of Jesus' teachings is simply mind-blowing.
It's a powerful reminder that these ancient texts are still relevant.
Absolutely.
Still alive with meaning for us today.
Yeah.
They invite us to think critically, to question our assumptions, and to live more intentionally in light of what we've learned.
To wrap this up, could you summarize some of the key themes that emerged from our exploration of the Book of the Covenant?
We've seen a God who is deeply concerned with justice, compassion, and the well-being of all creation.
Okay.
These laws, while rooted in a specific time and place, offer timeless principles that can guide us toward a more just and compassionate world.
And they challenge us to examine our own lives.
Yeah.
Our relationships and our understanding of what it means to be in right relationship with God and each other.
Precisely. The Book of the Covenant is more than just a historical artifact. Huh. It's a source of wisdom and inspiration that can help us navigate the complexities of life and faith in our own time.
It's been an incredibly enriching journey. Thank you so much for your insights.
The pleasure was all mine. And to you listening, we leave you with this.
Okay.
The Book of the Covenant reveals a God who desires justice, mercy, and humility.
Mm-hmm.
How might these ancient laws inspire you to live differently? To love more deeply and to walk more humbly in the world today.